Very well, thank you, Sue. And I'll have the marshal introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Johnson, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning once again to counsel and those participants who are listening. This is the virtual Court of Appeals panel number four, March 24. This is our first of three oral matters that we are considering today. And I'll note for the record, the first matter is A-2011-60, in re the estate of Joanne Wazelia Gregory. And as counsel likely is aware, everything is the same except we're not together. And that means that 50 minutes for appellant's counsel, 50 minutes for respondent's counsel, 5 minutes of rebuttal. Hopefully you can see the clock in the corner in one of your boxes on your computer screen. And the marshal knows that if at any time we lose contact with you to stop the clock until we resume a connection. We do also ask that you identify your full name for the record when you begin your comments. And we'll just remind all other participants who are listening that the recording of any nature is prohibited by judicial branch rules, though this proceeding and all proceedings of our court are available on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and begin, please.
Good morning. My name is Tim Lamb, Timothy C. Lamb. I'm an attorney here in North Dakota. Represent the appellants, Ron and Jeff Gregory. And may it please the court, judges and opposing counsel, Mr. Chesky, today we address a couple very important issues before the court. And these issues are going to affect my client's livelihood. The court has an issue to establish the standard for a PR, personal representative, in their fiduciary role in a probate of an estate, especially when you're considering the sale of a farmstead or real estate. In this instance, my clients, their livelihood is at risk here. If the court decides to uphold the lower court, they lose a fourth generation farmstead. If the court decides to reverse the lower court, my clients have the opportunity to purchase the farmstead from the estate. And we believe that's the prudent and best course of action in this case. The history of this particular—
Mr. Lamb, can I just ask you a question separate from the issue, and we may talk about this later, that of course we give discretion to the court's findings because obviously your client's recollection of communication between the personal representative and them differs from the personal representative, and the court made some findings. But I wanted to focus in my question with regard to 524.3715, and particular in paragraph parentheses 23, which allows for a personal representative to sell property unless the property has been specifically devised to a devisee or heir by the decedent's will and without consent of any of the heirs. My question is, given that, and you made reference, for instance, to the Steen decision, and in one of your headings, you make reference to lack of communication with your clients, but doesn't that statute make it fairly clear that she didn't have to? And again, the court made findings that she indeed did, but I mean, just separate from that, as a matter of law, if we're looking at the court's decision de novo, and there's no requirement that she get their consent, how would that be an error by the court to sell the land?
Well, but that's by the just the language of that statute, it's fairly broad. And as this court has, and as the common law has clarified the statute in Steen, is that there are some details that a PR should do. And I think this case actually brings before the court a situation where this court can be a little bit more definitive in how it wishes the these actions to be taken place.
Just to clarify, though, Mr. Lamb, Steen was referencing the 524-3607 proceeding, a restraining order proceeding. And in my review of the record, your client did not bring such an action. So again, since 715 allows for a sale without consent, then isn't that, we're bound by that clear directive of that statute in reviewing this record, are we not?
Well, I think in my client's behalf here, Your Honor, the argument that we're trying to make here is that there should be some formality, a standard here that a PR uses to sell the property. And it's just not a willy-nilly, the PR can do whatever the PR wishes to do in this instance. And I think when an heir comes before to purchase the property, that should give have some deference. And the statute taken just by itself, I think you're correct in that it gives the authority of the PR, gives them a lot of authority. And that's good in a sense, because we don't want to be second guessing the PR. But in this instance, in this particular case, the PR, I think, overstepped her bounds by not allowing the heirs the potential, the possibility of purchasing a fourth generation farmstead. And that, I think the details of this particular case just show that there wasn't any deference given to my clients. And
do you have any evidence? What is your evidence of communications from your clients to the PR before she listed the property, expressing an interest in purchasing the farm?
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, I think that the real question here is what did the PR do to fulfill her duties in making sure that all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted here, that she's in a fiduciary role. She's not acting as an heir, which she is also an heir. She's a beneficiary of the estate. And we would contend that there's a conflict there.
Well, but I mean, the way you phrased your argument, it sounds like you were saying in this situation, when there are heirs who wish to purchase it, or I thought that was the gist of your argument. But I guess, so my question is, you know, did the heirs communicate to her their interest in purchasing it before she listed it?
No, I think I have to understand that the heirs were not really apprised of the potential of purchasing the property. In fact, the meetings that they had didn't really go into the possibility that they have a right to purchase the property. And the PR hired a law firm that specializes in this area, but my clients were not apprised until I came on in after the purchase agreement was signed that they had a right to purchase that property. They could have purchased it outright. They could have partitioned 30% of it to the PR. They could have traded some other property for it. There were a lot of options that they had to make this happen, and they really didn't know that they had these options. So
at the time of the hearing before the judge, did your clients have a particular proposal, or did they have a specific means of financing a purchase?
They have been checking into that. They really didn't have much time, to tell you the truth, Your Honor. I think we made that a point at the hearing, is that they had no time before, from the time the property was put up for sale and the time that it was actually sold. It was 2 weeks of time there. So
I mean,
my clients really didn't have an opportunity to get funding or even make an offer.
I mean, wasn't there several months before decedent's death and the PR's listing of the property? How many months?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that argument or that fact is being used against my clients. And I think it's really a fact that is detrimental to the PR. She did not take any action to have an appraisal of that property during that 1 year time frame. She did not give any formal correspondence to the other heirs saying, "Hey, we're going to sell this property." So it really goes against her, not my clients.
Well, I asked because you just said in response to my previous question that your clients didn't have time to work up a proposal. And I guess the point of my question is they could have started thinking about it after the party's mother had passed away. And I think there was quite a bit of time for them to be working on a proposal in between that date and the date of the hearing. Isn't that true?
That's true, Your Honor. But the point I'm trying to make here is the mother died in the kitchen of the farmstead. The boys are pretty distraught over this. And quite frankly, I don't think they were any position to do anything. In fact, I think that was a problem for the first at least 6 months after she died, is that not only the boys, but the daughter were going through the grievance process, and the mother died totally unexpectedly. And so the boys were not in any position to offer to buy the land. In fact, there wasn't really any discussion about it. The time they had a meeting in August with the PR.
Could I ask you, because we're talking about findings of fact, and I'm looking at the court's order, and if we look at findings of fact 9 and 10, at least in 9, there's an indication that she repeatedly tried to contact your clients and gave them and with calls and texts attempting to identify assets and debts and inquiring as to what their wishes were. And then in 10, it says over the next 9 months, she continued to ask them what their plans were and whether they had secured new housing. In fact, the finding is that Ronald told her that he and Jeffrey were going to find another place to live, according to this order, and that the dairy operation was operating at a loss, that she wasn't given a clear answer until April 29, 2020, and that she received on that date a text message saying that they intended to move off the property so that it could be divided up. Is there anything in the record that you're saying that doesn't support that? Or is there evidence in the record that would support it? I guess that's our inquiry, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I appreciate that question, because that's one of the problems in this case, is there is no formal track of what the correspondence has been. Unlike the Steen case, where there's letters back and forth and formalities involved, this case, there's no formalities. In fact, everything hinges on a one text correspondence of that April 29th. And one text, that triggered the $1.5 million transaction, that's very dubious.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, our standard of review is that you have to show that you have the burden in this appeal to show that these facts are clearly erroneous.
Well, the fact is, Your Honor, is there isn't any evidence, anything on the record except that text message of
April 29th. Well, what about her testimony?
Nothing else is on the record.
Yeah, but what about her testimony?
Her testimony is that there was a number of calls, but there is nothing on the record to show that. In fact, clients testified to the contrary.
But the court obviously accepted her testimony and found it to be credible. Isn't that sufficient?
Well, it may be sufficient, but when we're talking about a fiduciary responsibility, Your Honor, and the high standard that relates to that, we would like to have a little bit more substance than just one text message to trigger a $1 million transaction. And that's what we're calling to the court's attention. It's just not sufficient.
I mean, if the court did find that her testimony was credible, and it obviously did because it ruled that her actions were reasonable, and that she'd tried, that it was her understanding for at least 9 months here, it looks like, that your clients were going to move off the farm. And the farm was in fact operating at a loss, and that she was having to pay creditors. If in fact these findings, if we have to defer to these findings, particularly the credibility findings, I mean, how can we reverse this? I mean, is there any issue that, with assuming these facts to be true, which we have to do unless you show they're clearly erroneous, what error of law was there here?
Clients
actually consented to it and indicated for 9 months they were going to be moving.
And why, Mr. Lamb, I'll just clarify
your actions unreasonable.
Feel free to answer the question, though your time has expired. Please do.
Has expired, Your Honor, but I would like to have some time in rebuttal to address this. But basically,
would you rather do? I was going to say you can do that if you wish, or if you want to answer right now, that's fine.
Okay, I'll just make this very, very brief. Is that those facts that you just laid out, Your Honor, are all erroneous? The fact is, and we articulated this in the briefs, is that those financial records are all based on the dairy operation, not the entire farm, and the boys are taking responsibility for that. Ron and Chuck take responsibility. It's not a ding anything against the estate. In fact, the law says that the state is exempt from any creditors, so that argument really doesn't hold any water. And the argument that the boys were moving, they mentioned that after the mother died because they were so distraught, but not, they never brought that up again, and they couldn't find a place. So that argument really doesn't hold any water. And I think Ron testified to that in his testimony. So as far as those arguments that they were moving or that there was a need to sell the farm, they just are clearly erroneous based on the evidence on the record. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Very well, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Anton Cheskis on behalf of the respondent, Judith Vogel as the personal representative for the estate of Joanne Gregory. Faced with the difficult decision regarding the estate and its failing farm operation, respondent gave her brothers over 13 months to decide what they wanted to do with the farmstead property. Her brothers used that time to stall and continue to waste estate assets on a farming operation that that was losing money every month. Finally, after receiving confirmation from her brothers to sell the farmstead, respondent engaged a real estate agent to sell the property and obtained a fair and reasonable price, according to both real estate experts that testified at trial. Respondent's actions were fair and reasonable in all her dealings concerning the property. We respectfully request that the appeal be denied in its entirety. As the court has already hit on, the main issue here is whether the approval of the sale of the farmstead was clearly erroneous based on the PR's duty to act in good faith. And as to the standard of care, Minnesota law states that part of the PR's duty in settling and distributing the estate, PR may sell real estate, any other property of the estate, including the homestead, as long as the PR acts reasonably for the benefit of the interested persons. And that, Judge Slider mentioned, was 524.3-715-23. And as we've also discussed, even though we did not need the heir's consent in this case, the PR thought it was appropriate and important to include her brothers in the decision-making process regarding this property. Appellants used that compassion to delay respondent's ability to properly administer the estate. Over a year passed before they truly gave a definitive indication of what they wanted to do with this farmstead property. And really, like the beneficiaries in the unpublished Steam case that appellants strangely rely on, appellants engaged in no due diligence attempts to buy out Ms. Vogel's one-third interest in the farmstead or any other plausible resolution for this failing property until after the purchase agreement was already entered into, again, over 13 months after the estate administration commenced. It was well established at trial that the estate has significant debts. Now, the estate had non-exempt assets to pay those debts, but those non-exempt assets were being depleted constantly by this farmstead property, and the PR could not allow that waste to continue. That's why she continually attempted to contact her brothers to get a resolution on, hey, what are we doing with this property?
I have a question about that, Mr. Cheskus, that the estate was illiquid. But I also read in the record that just, I think, 2 years earlier or 1 year earlier, the decedent had sold an 80-acre parcel yielding about $500,000. Is that right?
There was a sale, Your Honor. That sale was used to pay off some mortgages. It was used to pay down other debts. I mean, again, this is a operation that's losing money every day, right? So yes, that money went into coffers and that money was accounted for in the initial inventory that the estate filed. So again, if the court looks at that inventory, it'll see at that time there were non-exempt assets. Those non-exempt assets were earmarked for other creditors of the estate that were legitimate. And they were also being used by what Mr. Lamb refers to as the boys, who, by the way, are in their 50s, to pay for this ongoing farming operation. And Ms. Vogel actually gave the heirs a estate debit card to use, which they used on, you know, various farming operation expenses, including some non-farming operation expenses. But in any event,
Did the decedent during her lifetime rent out the farmland? I mean, rent out the tillable acres? Or my understanding is that the appellants ran only a dairy operation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah, I believe the neighbor that actually purchased the other 80 acres then was farming that property beforehand. And was paying rent. But in any event, all of the expenses and, you know, the income and loss statement that was provided along with Ms. Vogel's supplemental affidavit, which is at our appendix, page 6, takes into account any money coming in for those 13 months, shows the money going out. And the net result was a loss of about $32,000. During those 13 months. So, and with, by the way, no evidence of potential improvement. So, this is an asset owned by the estate that's draining money from other assets of the estate. And essentially, the other heirs are just requesting that the estate subsidize them in perpetuity until the estate's completely out of money. And again, I'll direct or invite the court's attention to the standard of care, which is that the PR must act for the reasonable benefit of the interested persons, right? That includes legitimate creditors as well as the heirs. So if there's money there to pay legitimate creditors that are not, that's from non-exempt assets, you know, it, frankly, there might be an argument that it's a fraudulent transfer to transfer that money to this farming operation for the benefit of two of the heirs to the detriment of other creditors. So again, after involving the brothers in this process, after getting direction that, hey, go ahead, sell the farmstead. You want Randy Kubisch to do it for you. That's exactly what Ms. Vogel did. She hired a professional real estate agent that's very well experienced. He got a great price in a fairly short order time period and entered into a purchase agreement that's now been approved by the district court.
Can I ask you this? You know, one of the arguments made by the appellant is that this sale was not commercially reasonable, and noting first of all that this the realtor pocketed about $58,000 on a pot. Well, it was basically a pocket sale that wasn't even listed on MLS. That it if it had been listed, it would have been they could have gotten a lot more money. I mean, how do you respond to those arguments it was done so quickly and without being, you know, without negotiating with the realtor to get the fee down. I mean, why is this commercially reasonable under these circumstances?
Thank you for the question, Judge Hooten. Regarding valuation, this is not an issue of first impression in this court. Minnesota codified how to value estate assets in 1974 in 524.3-906A3. That states that the PR may ascertain value of an estate's asset for distribution, quote, in any reasonable way, unquote. And we cite the 1994 Supreme Court case, U.S. v. O'Shaughnessy, and the 2003 Court of Appeals case in Re Estate of King. They all stand for the proposition that as long as the personal representative acts within the bounds of reasonable judgment, courts will not interfere with their decisions. Now, in this case, Randy Kubisch testified at length regarding farmstead characteristics, development potential, condition concerns, comparable properties in the area, and the efforts that he ultimately undertook to seek out potential buyers and ultimately to secure a buyer. He testified at length why there are times when you do not list a property on the MLS, which it could actually hurt the valuation of the ultimate value of the property. The appellant's expert, Yvonne Perkins, testified in their case in chief. She refused to say that this was not a commercially reasonable price. She affirmatively stated this was, quote, not a bad price, end quote. So the only testimony that's of record, the only evidence that's of record that this is not commercially reasonable was lay testimony from Ronald Gregory, who has no experience in valuing, appraising, or selling farm property. And for some reason, he thinks it's worth $1.5 million. Now, just looking at the record, I believe he thinks that because at some point there was testimony that Yvonne Perkins had a buyer at $1.5 million. That was before COVID, and she testified that that buyer was no longer interested by the time the property was on the market. And that, just to clarify, on the market does not necessarily mean on the MLS. It just means it's for sale. And Mr. Kubisch also testified that he contacted other real estate agents. This is a small world of these farm properties that these agents live in. So, you know, he made his contacts, also discussed the issue with Ms. Perkins, who told him the buyer's no longer available, and ultimately landed on the buyer that he landed on, which was a natural buyer. That's true. They had previously purchased the other 80 acres, several years before, but they did not accept the first offer. They made a counter offer and ended up in the middle at $1.15 million, which again, everyone that testified indicated was a good commercially reasonable price. And I will just note that interestingly, this is the same issue that the court in Steen had a footnote about, that if Ronald Gregory, who thinks the property is worth $1.5 million, but is only willing to pay the $1.15 million that was in the purchase agreement, If he's wrong about the value, then there's no harm to the estate because the price is the same. But if he's right, then he's trying to take advantage of the estate by refusing to pay fair market value and only offering a price that's in his mind well below that. But in any event, the
Mr.
district
Cheskis,
court.
I'm sorry. Did you finish your thought?
My only finish was, in any event, the district court made these credibility determinations and already decided that regarding valuation, the PR acted fairly and reasonably in all her dealings with the property, including the price.
And that perhaps dovetails in my question. Mr. Lamb makes the point that the findings or facts that Judge Hooten was referring to in terms of communication and efforts by the PR to his clients, there's a number of findings which suggested they were not responding and she was attempting to get their response and they were uncooperative and so forth. I assume you disagree in terms of clearly erroneous, and that being the case, what part of the record in particular would you direct us to support the court's findings in that regard?
Several places, Your Honor. Number one, certainly the PR's testimony, direct testimony regarding her repeated attempts to contact her brothers via text message, via phone call. Number two, there was at least one meeting that everyone agreed occurred with one of my partners, Allison Gontarek, Ronald Gregory, and Judith Vogel. That was back in August of 2019. That was the initial meeting that Ronald Gregory indicated that, yeah, we'll move, we'll find somewhere else to go. And I'd also just generally point to Ronald Gregory's testimony that indicated that, yeah, she called me all the time when I was working, right? He does admit, and I apologize, I don't have the pen site here with me, but there was testimony by Ronald Gregory, at least acknowledging attempts by Judith Vogel to contact him. There's no requirement in the law for a form for special notices that the PR needs to use or letterhead that needs to be sent out. The point is, even though we did not have an obligation to involve them in this decision-making process, we chose to do that. And that decision resulted in us being totally ignored and stalled and delayed. And in the meantime, the estate is subsidizing this asset that's losing thousands of dollars every month. The converse, I would argue that a PR that's allowing that to continuously happen now is in breach of a fiduciary duty. If this was a professional fiduciary, just allowing an estate asset to continually lose money, I'm sure Mr. Lamb would be here screaming bloody murder that this PR needs to be removed because we've got an estate asset that's being wasted. So that's where I would point, Your Honor, to the record as far as supporting the evidence that attempts to contact were made. No offers were received prior to a purchase agreement being entered into. That part is not in dispute.
And Mr. Cheskis, the second issue raised by Mr. Lamb's client relates to, I saw it in a finding of fact, and I think you pointed that out, where the court reiterates what the will divides equally to the three heirs, and hence use the phrase one third. I don't know if that's actually in the will. I think it's just residue equally. But is your point being that the court has made no adjudication? There's nothing for us to review. But furthermore, then that means the heirs are not precluded before a final settlement of raising that issue if they choose to do so.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. I'll argue if and when that happens that they're time barred now based on various statute of limitations regarding how a will is challenged. But that issue is not before this court, right? The court in the findings was merely reciting the order of appointment dated March 14th of 2019. Nobody ever appealed that order. The will has never been challenged for fraud or duress or lack of capacity or undue influence. So, we would argue that as a matter of law, then that the order of appointment is now the rule of law for this estate. But in any event, the findings in the order approving sale are just used by the court to constitute grounds for its action, which is the five paragraphs of the actual order. And that's Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure 5201. So the appeal as to the issue of the disposition of the estate, we would argue is erroneous. And again, we'd respectfully request that also be denied. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cheskis, and counsel for appellant. You may now have 5 minutes, Mr. Lamb. You may proceed. You are muted. You'll have to unmute yourself. But the marshal was paying attention, didn't start the clock there. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. I little oversight there, but the Zoom court here. In any event, I think what is at issue here is whether the PR, the standard for her professional or for the standard for a conduct of a personal representative in a fiduciary, which is supposed to be the highest standard that we have under the law for carrying out a duty. And I think in this particular instance, what this court is faced with, and it's a tough decision, grant you that. And then that is whether in this instance that the PR did everything that should have been done. And not only with what is commercially reasonable and making sure that there was an appraisal, she could have gone directly to that buyer and sold the property directly to him without going through a real estate agent and charging the estate $57,000 for the commission. So,
Mr. Lamb, on that point, though, that almost seems in conflict to your client's position that the real estate agent should have put it on MLS and should have expanded the sale. But if I understand the point you're making there is, if you're going to sell to the neighbor, the real estate agent or the PR should just directly dealt. Is that
what you're referring to? The person that bought it, the entity that bought the farm or signed the purchase agreement, they had already purchased 80 acres of that farmstead. So they were known. In fact, she said in her testimony that he was a natural buyer. I put that in as a footnote in my brief, but she knew he was a natural buyer and purchaser, and she didn't approach him. So that was an error on her part. I think too, when you say about MLS, that goes way beyond the bounds of the local community. That goes out to the entire United States. So what happened in this instance is all of those potential buyers that would be looking at in this area, and there are a number. This Minnesota farmland is a hot ticket, and real estate right now is super hot. So the idea that there's just a small market here, that is clearly misleading.
Well, Mr. Lamb, just to clarify again from the record, and my understanding, because it's a probate proceeding, we may look at it de novo. Isn't it true there was no expert who said that this sale was commercially unreasonable? And further, there was evidence that, in fact, it was reasonable and an explanation for it and not going on MLS. So what would we look at from a de novo review to say that was error and reverse the decision and say it's unreasonable if all the experts said did not do so?
Well, I think Ms. Perkins did testify that in her experience that in an estate, and we're talking about an estate, that her experience is that there is appraisal done, it's put on the MLS, and it's done in a transparent fashion. So in this instance, it didn't follow what, in her expert opinion, should have been followed. Now, you know, she did say, that the price was not unreasonable, but that doesn't mean that the process for arriving at that price was reasonable. And that's what we're getting at here. If we allow this transaction to be the standard in Minnesota, then that gives PRs carte blanche to just about do anything they want. And I think that's would be a really detrimental to Minnesota and the farmers in Minnesota. And in this case, my clients, I call them the boys because they're two guys, they're in their 50s, but they've been on the farm for 30 years. They'll be off that farm. They love the farm and what this decision, if you rule against them, would oust them from a fourth generation farmstead. And they have the means to make, to buy it out. They have over $1 million in another part of the estate that is being just ignored. It was ignored by the district court, and it's being ignored by the opposing counsel. So with that, your honors, I ask you to reverse the lower court and allow my clients to purchase this property. Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Thank you both counsel for your comments today, answers to our questions, as well as your briefing. We will be taking the matter under advisement and issue a ruling in the statutory 90-day time period. You each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.